The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Heretics Hour on July 8th, 2013. I am going to be speaking tonight about the Third Reich and the word Nazi. You know, I was actually a few days ago, maybe three, I was thinking about, I was thinking about what I'd talk about tonight. And I thought, getting away from everything that's, you know, things in the news, things that I think should be important or are important or what people want to hear or any of these things, you know, what is it that I would really like to say? What would I like to talk about more than anything else? And then I thought, like, what's in my heart? And I was like sensing, what was in my heart? And guess what's there? The Third Reich. And that really is something that is deep in my feelings and probably number one in my thinking and my concern. And I started thinking about why that was. And so I'm going to talk about that a little bit tonight. And in the meantime, it came up, this word, whether to use the word Nazi or not, came up both on comments to the last International Jew program that Hattie Scott and I did. That was kind of an aside that we discussed or in some way, and it stirred up some people to comment. And then it also, I went over to the Scrapbook Pages blog run by the person who calls himself Further Glory. So I typed in a comment on this blog about Ashkenazi Jews and the kind of specific diseases they have, because I had gotten, intrigued by the Ashkenazi because of a comment at the White Network. So all this, and then there were some responses to that. So there was some conversation about it on the Scrapbook Pages blog under this blog post about Angela Jolie and her breast cancer, because she's an Ashkenazi Jew, and her potential breast cancer, and what she did about it, and also on the White Network under the last International Jew show, which was about Bolshevik hotspots in the United States. So I'm going to kind of jump into this tonight and just start out by saying that I think I put in my announcement that I sent out quite late that the worldwide perception of the Third Reich and its leaders and followers must change for there to be any improvement in the situation of white people. And I was thinking about why that is so, but I don't have any of that actually written down. I was busy writing other things down, but it's that everything that white people need to have happen and need to do and understand in order to fight back, but mostly in order to stop this massive movement against ourselves, is embodied in the Third Reich in the National Socialist regime and program. And as long as we are convinced or are brainwashed or indoctrinated that this is all bad and we cannot ever repeat such a thing and we cannot think along these lines, then we are absolutely, our hands are tied for doing anything to defend ourselves and to improve our own situation. And I know that plenty of people say, and they're sincere people and good people in the pro-white, amongst the pro-white activists, say we can avoid, we don't have to go to that, and we don't want to go to that, and we can talk about white issues and why whites are have a right to speak up for their own interests and so on without ever bringing up the National Socialist movement in Germany and World War II and all those concentration camps and all brings in the Holocaust and all that stuff. We don't want to go there, and as I already said, we don't need to, but they say we don't need to, but why can't we make any headway amongst our own people? I do believe at least there is one main reason, maybe the most important reason, or at least a major reason, although to me it's basically the only reason. But to others, they might not see it that way. But still, you have to see it as a very important reason, because everything that we need to do has been supposedly discredited already by this National Socialist movement and regime. And therefore, as long as we see that as bad and evil, we can't talk about those things. We can't talk about white interests. We can't talk about race. We can't talk about Jews. We can't talk about nationalism. We can't talk about national interests. We can't talk about any of those things without being accused, or without people being afraid that they will be accused, or they will be seen as, or that maybe they're even afraid that, my gosh, I'm thinking along the lines of these horrible, you know, people. Can't think that way. So I'm afraid I don't have a real detailed explanation of what I'm saying here, but I know most of you understand what I'm saying, so I'll just go on rather than belabor the point. What the Third Reich tried to do was to secure the German homeland for the German people, just like any people on a homeland of their own. Jews want Israel. And oh my gosh, you know, how much has been made out of their right to have their homeland the way they want it? That's all that the German homeland was, the German Third Reich was trying to do. And many German governments had been trying to do that. Of course, the First and the Second Reich, especially. But where the story gets screwed up is that because of World War I, and I'll get into that a little bit later, how that was brought about in order to harm Germany and stop Germany's developing their nationalist homeland, that because so much territory was taken away from Germany, and they were put under that really horrible Treaty of Versailles, which I won't go into, but they lost so much. They lost parts of their people and so on. So when Adolf Hitler was trying to rebuild the German homeland again, a very important on his agenda was bringing back these people and the territories that they lived in, some of these territories. Again, so this then developed into the idea that Hitler was trying to expand and into other people's nations and steal their land and take and, you know, and grow and develop a huge empire in Europe and so on. Well, a lot of things developed in the course of right before the war and during the war, and you know the kind of things that were machinations that were going on against Germany that the German government was aware of. So yeah, a lot of things started happening that would not have happened otherwise. And I do believe that Hitler would have gotten back the Sudetenland and some of the Polish Silesia and so on, and some of those Polish territories, Danzig and all of that, and then there would have been, it would have had Germany would have had Austria back in its fold again, and which it did, and all of that, that would have been it. But at that last step there, that last step, which was forced because of the Polish behavior against the Germans living in Poland, and the Danzig Corridor refusal and so on, was forced on Germany to act. That's where it went bad. And after that, when you're at war, you have to try to get territory. You have to go in with your armies, and you have to take territory, and you have to occupy areas. So, anyway, I still say that all that the Third Reich wanted to do was to secure a German homeland, and we all deserve to have a homeland. You know, I've been talking lately about trying to focus on America and realize that I'm an American, and I'm so used to thinking that this country belongs to people of my own kind, and that, you know, we're totally safe here and secure, and it's our country and so on, that it is hard. And I think this is the problem that American white people have in really seeing the situation that they're in as it really is, because they're so used to thinking that we have no problems here in the United States of America. We're so safe, you know, and we're so solid, and this is our nation, and we have all this democracy, and we vote. The problem is democracy. The problem is democracy. So in a democracy, you are open to people who want to come there, and so you it's not that, it's not a home. The United States is not considered a homeland for European Americans, Anglo-Saxons, or anything like that. It's considered a place for immigrants now, a place for people to come to from all over the world. This is not a homeland. This is not a homeland for us. So let me move on and say, let's see, I'm going to skip some of this for now. I've got a little thing here about gay marriage, but it doesn't really fit into what I'm saying. So I'll say that when I went over to there's this too. I hope I can remember to come back to this. It's kind of interesting. But the use, I'm going to get, since I titled the show about the use of the word Nazi, I'm going to get into this debate here first off, and I already told you that there was a little bit going on at Scrapbook Page's blog under that post about Angelina Jolie, and then there's been comments at the White Network, and I've got those up here on the program Jewish Hotbeds of Bolshevism in the United States. That was the international Jew program from last week. Now, the question is, there's two questions here. Should we use the word Nazi ever, you know, and the other question is, what does the word Nazi mean, and what is Ashkenazi, and does it come from Ashkenazi? And I have had people trying to tell me that both of these things are trying to convince me. Here, and, you know, now and then I get emails from people, and some people are very irate that I use the word Nazi. That's the biggest one. You know, I've had quite a few people tell me, will you please stop using that word to describe National Socialism? That's a Jewish term that the Jews have came up with, and they use that to demean and insult National Socialism. and you're just helping them along. And there's a lot of people who believe this. Now, I know that the word, they always use the word Nazi. The American military started that right at the end of World War II, and even before, well before. They always use the word Nazi because they think it doesn't sound good. And they've tried to make it into a kind of a negative sound feeling word. And they never use National Socialism, hardly at all, if they can help it. And the Jews, you know, all the Jewish press and everything, it's always Nazi, Nazi. So I understand how people feel this way. But facts are facts, you know, and I don't think that, as some people say, that the Jews invented this word. And I don't think it comes at all from Ashkenazi. Now, most people realize that, although there are those hardcore, I don't know, conspiracy lovers who like to put together things without really knowing much anything about it, but because how it looks to them and how it fits together and seems like, wow, what a discovery. Look at here, this Jewish word Ashkenazi, and look at N-A-Z-I, it ends in, and that's Nazi. That must be where Nazi comes from. And then they make all kinds of theories based on that. And they don't want to let that go because they think they've discovered something great. I think mostly it's not people who are trying to, who know better and are disruptors or agents or Jews or something, because Jews don't necessarily want Nazi to be associated with their word Ashkenazi. So, I think it's mostly misguided people on white people who are doing this. Now, I don't know if I've made it clear here. Let me see if what I come up with. So, well, I started out, I'll try to make this clear. I started out on the Scrapbook Pages blog by when I read that post, because I had already gotten an email at the White Network. And, a comment, but I didn't post it because it seemed to be all confused and I didn't like what it was saying. It's not that if I don't post something, it's because I don't like what it's saying, but if I think it's really saying things that are sending people off into the wrong direction or really misrepresenting something, and I don't have time or feel like answering it and straightening it out. I really wonder whether I should post it or not. And this one I didn't, but I did write a comment to this person about what he wrote without even posting his. And he very nicely answered back. And he realized I didn't want to post his comment. And he answered back. And then we had another back and forth. And so there's some information there. But I'll start then with what I wrote on Scrapbook Pages blog, which was just, so where does the term Ashkenazim come from? Because he had been saying, this other fellow had been saying that it was, came from the, what was it, the second son of Noah or the second generation from Noah or something of a person named Ashkenaz, a descendant of Noah. Whose name is Ashkenaz, and he's supposed to be the father of white people. This is what I objected to just say that Ashkenaz is the father of white people. And a brother of Ashkenaz had a different name, and he is the father of non-white people or something. So that's in the Bible, okay? But that doesn't mean that it's true or that it has anything to do with us or what we should be concerned about it, you know, at all. So I didn't find that to be something that people should devote their thinking to. But I did then bring it up on on Scrapbook Pages saying, where does this term come from? See if anybody had a, you know, see what anybody would say. And I don't believe what the Jews write about it, just on their say-so, whatever they write about it, whatever it might be. It certainly has no relation to Nazi, I said, which is a shortened form of National Socialist, spelling it with the Z, National Socialist. But it's understandable that people come to believe that it does. So that I left it at that, and somebody answered, and this, I think I can give his name because he put his name here and his website, and he's not hiding anything, and he's a pretty good guy, is James Laffrey. Wrote, the first time I've seen James Laffrey on Scrapbook Pages, and his website is whiteswillwinparty.org. He, you know, I'm familiar with him, but I haven't looked, intrigued by him a couple years ago or whatever, I guess. I read some of his website, but something, I don't know what it was, something bothered me, and I just never went back, and all this time, and I haven't followed him, and I know his name. And he wrote, in response to what I wrote, "Carolyn, you do a lot of good work and some awful." Well, that's not too good of a way to start out talking to me, but I probably do the same thing to other people. I don't start out in a very good way. But, you know, he said, an awful example. See, I don't think I do any awful work. I think I do a lot of good work, and I do a lot of work, but I don't think any of it is awful. But he thinks some of it is awful. And he said, an awful example is, quote, Nazi. He says, it is not a shortened form of National Socialist. And he puts in parentheses, Eustace Mullins also said that later in his life. And he, too, was wrong. Well, Eustace Mullins was right later in his life. But James goes on to say, such a shortening would reasonably be Nazo, N-A-S-O. See, that's where he's confusing. He's not a German speaker, I'm sure, as I am not. And but you know, I want to interject here that James Laffrey is, seems to me, this, I looked over his website more today, and I was amazed, really, and impressed by a lot of things he's doing, and he is really coming on hardcore, and I don't remember him being hardcore like this. I like to use that word, hardcore. A couple years ago when I was looking, reading his website. But I can't say for sure, but I may not remember it right. But that's what I see now. So I'm gonna go back and, I was reading some interesting things. I've come across a few things that I wouldn't exactly agree with, but not much. And, I do want to have him on my program. In fact, I wrote to him today and ask him if he could come in the second hour tonight, but I didn't get a response. But I will ask, see if I can get him on the program as a regular guest sometime in the future if he's willing to do it. I'm pretty interested in his site and what he's writing. So that said, I'll go on with what he says here. If it was a shortened form of National Socialist or Socialist, or even if it's pronounced in German way, National Socialisten, which I'm not saying right, but he thinks it would be the first letter of the first two words of National and the first two words of Socialist. See, N-A from National and S-O from Socialist. And I'm going into detail on this because so many people have these ideas and don't know what's wrong with them. It's not that, because he's going by the spelling, but not by the sound. And Nazi is from the sound, of Nazional. Nazional. But we're going to get into that because other people have brought that up. So, he said the term originates with the Jews. Why not see it right there in Ashkenazi? Well, this is too bad. And he wrote this just, you know, July 7th. So this is his current thinking, and this would be something where he's pretty short-sighted. He's fallen for this Ashkenazi business that's where Nazi comes from. I have to say, that doesn't speak too well for him. But anyway, he goes on to say, our enemy, Jewry, is infamous for tarring others with what the Jews themselves are. Well, true. And he says the great Germans of Hitler's NSDAP, and he appears to be totally a huge fan of Hitler and NSDAP, and he doesn't hide it. He's right out there in front with it. Maybe that's why he doesn't get very far with his party, so much like the rest of us. But he says the great Germans of Hitler's NSDAP never referred to themselves using that N-word. Well, I disagree with that, and I have a few examples to give coming up. But mostly they didn't use it. And he calls it the N-word. Nazi is the N-word. Well, that's okay. But, you know, the famous N-word is nigger. So now I don't like, in any way connecting Nazi with nigger as the N-word. But anyway, I don't think he clearly didn't mean to do that. And he says that Google's translator inserts Nazi in when the text doesn't have it. That's true. The thing I noticed with, I don't know about Google Translator, but Google, word programs, you know, word producing programs like Word and OpenOffice and so on. If you type in National Socialist, no, if you type in anti-Semitic, and put it all one word, it will automatically change to anti-Semitic with a hyphen and a capital S. That's what I've noticed. But I don't know. I know that it wouldn't change National Socialist to Nazi. But he says Google Translator does that. So he says that term came from the Jews. Okay, Nazi comes from the Jews. That's his definite opinion. We shouldn't use it in any way unless it also explains with each usage that it is a Jew-invented insult against the great Germans of the white race. And he signs his name very nicely, unlike most people do on comments like this. He says, sincerely, James Laffrey, whiteswillwinparty.org. Now, it's not just James, but as I said, I've had a lot of people write this to me, that I should never use it. It's a Jewish term. It's to insult the Germans. It's to insult the National Socialist Party and so on. I have disagreed with that for some time. And I often say why, but I did. So I did more research this time. And I said I need to do some research into this. So I feel certain about what I'm talking about, and if I don't agree with what people are saying. So I have done some in the last couple of days. So, and then Further Glory answered this comment by James, and he said correctly, I do not believe that the word Nazi originated from the word Ashkenazi. The term National Socialist is translated into German as Nationalsozialisten. The first two syllables of the German word are pronounced as Nazi. And that he is correct. I mean, he was correct probably before I was. I mean, I have looked into this, and I agree that that's the way it really is. It's pronounced National. That's how you pronounce the national. Nationalsozialisten. I'm not too good with that second part, but national, so to say, to cut it down to something shorter, is Nazi. Nazi, oh no, Nazi. And this is so common in German and in Germany and in Austria too. Austrians who speak German, they don't want to say the whole words, and they have long words, you know, and national is a lot to say. We say national. It's easy. You don't have to move your tongue very much. or your mouth very much, not national. We have kind of a lazy speech where the German is so particular and exactly and national. It's probably not hard for them, but it's it takes a little bit more work. And then you got that second part, too. So that's too much to say. So they say Nazi. It makes sense. Okay, I'll just say at this point, it makes sense. And all the people who seem to be more confident and more where they intelligent people who are looking for, who are not who are not just believing everything that comes along, say this and understand this. So, but then further Gloria goes on to say that I believe the term Nazi originated with American journalists in Germany. So again, the origination of it is he's again kind of going along with the fact that it's that it was Jews who, or he's Americans, and in a sense it's the same thing because they're anti-national socialist, anti-Hitler, so that they came up with it. And he says he thought it was William Shirer, the one who wrote that well-known book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, piece of junk journalism, but anyway, real long book that was big, big bestseller for a long time. And Shirer is definitely anti-national socialist. And so Further Glory says that he used the term Nazi in his book, The Nightmare Years, 1930 to 1940. And he thinks that's the first time that it was ever used in journalism or in American journalism or any kind of English-speaking journalism. He says here it was necessary to shorten the name of the German political party because National Socialisten was too long to put into a newspaper headline. Well, that's his journal. He used to be a journalist, and that's his thinking. Kind of makes sense. If the name had been shortened to Nati, N-A-T-I, Americans would not have known how to pronounce it. He means if it was pronounced Nazi, as the Germans would pronounce it. But, you know, we don't pronounce it that way, so it wouldn't work. So he thinks that's why it was spelled N-A-Z-I for Americans, coined by American journalists, to shorten the word National Socialist. I just can't agree with that. I can't agree. It may be, I know they were using it, and it's interesting that he came up with that. It's an interesting idea, but I can't quite think that they actually invented it. So I have, he goes on to say that this is his own opinion and about the way it originated, because it's very common for American journalists to make up words and abbreviations to save space in a headline. Well, that's all true, but I still don't think that that was yet. Anyway, I wrote to James and I linked to the comments at the White Network, and I said some things in the beginning I wish now I hadn't have said. And since I've looked further at his website, and you know how I'm as bad as anybody when it comes to writing comments without thinking enough about it and being a little bit over defensive or over aggressive, because he told me that some of what I do is awful. But I was saying that I know some instances where Germans use the word Nazi, and I know some Austrians who told me that yes, Nazi was used by the people, you know, during the 30s and so on, pro-National Socialist people, not the ones who hated the Nazis, the ones who loved the Nazis, and they were supporting the Nazis. And they tended to call it Nazi. Now, I keep saying the Nazis here because it's like we've already brought out, it's easier than saying National Socialist. I've kind of gotten used to it. I didn't think I used it that often, but I'm using it now because that's what we're talking about maybe. But normally I would try to say National Socialist, although not because I think that Nazi is a Jew word. Although it's kind of become one. All right, I agree with that. So, because I say here, it's true that the party, the National Socialist Party, encouraged to always use National Socialist for dignity's sake, and, you know, not to use Nazi. And I agree that Nazi shouldn't be used by officials or when officially speaking, but there are pro-NS people who use Nazi all the time, much more than I do. I usually say National Socialist, but in reading and quoting, I use what the source does. However, there's nothing wrong with the term Nazi, except that the National Socialist haters use it all the time, and only that word. And so, but I think it's weak, I say, to allow Jews to determine our language, which is what you and all the others who talk like this are doing. And then I said that, to further glory, that Shirer was the first to use it journalistically. That if Shirer was the first to use it journalistically in 1930, it doesn't mean that Jews invented it. It's, you know, you just can't really pin that down. I think it's pretty impossible to pin down who first used that, because it was in use in the 20s. So, but I didn't, then he said that he didn't think that Shirer was a Jew. He answered me that, and it did sound like I was saying that. I didn't mean that Shirer was a Jew, but the way I wrote it, it did sound that way. So I think Further Glory is one of the most fair-minded and gentlemanly people you can find in this, dealing with this topic, which is Holocaust, that he basically deals with. And I think a lot of him. I did look up Shirer to see. I thought he might be Jewish. I couldn't, you know, I wasn't sure. I know he's not considered to be, but I did look him up right before the show, and I can't find anything on Wikipedia that shows that he's Jewish. I don't think he is, but he certainly is in that mindset. Anyway, he worked for them, you know. I mean, when you're a writer and a journalist, you're working for the Jewish media and publishers and so on. And so he gets along just fine with them. He might as well be a Jew, but he's not. He's not actually. So now here's an interesting thing, you see, that comes from Hermy. Let's see. Look at how fast the time is going. Let me see. I still have listeners. Fantastic. Okay. Then there's a comment here from Hermie, who's a very good commenter. He's knowledgeable, but he does, what he's got here is he's, at least he tells you where it's from. He says something that, a couple of things I can't agree with. And again, I'm going through this not to disagree with people, or to say people are wrong or anything, but to try to clarify all the different arguments that come up about using the word Nazi and also the derivation of the word, that are the most typical that we hear, so that we can get to the bottom of this question. So Hermie says the NSDAP for a time attempted to adopt the Nazi designation as what the Germans call a despite word. Now, no, I'm not starting where he started. Sorry about that. I moved. He says, the term Ashkenazim comes from the biblical character named Ashkenaz. That's the same thing that Marcus was telling me at the White Network. I don't doubt that. You know, I mean, of course, that's true. But I say it doesn't have anything to do with us, but at least it's part of the facts of it. And the term Nazi was invented and popularized abroad by Jews, early opponents of National Socialism and German exiles abroad. Now, he got this, and he says so, from the 24th edition of Etymologisches Wörterbuch der deutschen Sprache. Well, I found that in English, too, as I was just going through some things. So it's, you know, the etymology of the German words in the German language, and this is what it says about Nazi, but I don't think it's correct. And all of these sources, just because they sound good as sources or sound really important or official or something, are not necessarily any good, or do not necessarily, let me say, have the truth about a certain every matter that they write about. And somewhere else it's called an encyclopedia, I guess. Wörterbuch is a dictionary. It says that, I don't want to go through all this stupid. Nazi was favored in southern Germany among opponents of National Socialism. Well, it was. Yeah, the opponents of National Socialism from the start loved calling National Socialism Nazi and Nazism. They did. They called the followers Nazis. And that's true, but that doesn't mean that the followers of National Socialism didn't also call themselves Nazi. And you know that, but they also called themselves, they knew their name was National Socialist, and the opponents didn't want to ever use that name. And so yeah, they were trying to use it to mean, there's also this idea that it derives from the proper name Ignaz, which is a German form of Ignatius, or whatever that word is, Ignaz, Ignatius. And it was this proper name, you know, like so many names, this has a colloquial meaning. And in this case, it's a foolish person, a clumsy or awkward person. So an Ignaz or Ignatius is also denotes a clumsy or foolish person. And it was a popular name in Catholic Austria, it says. And so according to one source in World War I, it was the generic name in the German Empire for soldiers of Austria-Hungary. So they were calling the Austria-Hungary soldiers Ignatzes, or, you know, the Germans were. Well, I'm not sure what all that means, but it says, he says, Nazi was also meant to mirror the term Sozi, the name for the German socialists were called when the word Nazi was attributed to NSDAP. Well, that's right. See, the NSDAP members were called Nazis, and the socialist or communist members are the Marxists, you know, the Marxist socialists, which were quite numerous and were fighting the National Socialists, were called Sozis, because, you know, for socialists. So there was the Nazis and the Sozis, and that this was commonly used by the people to talk about these two groups, you know, and maybe to say which one you like best or which side you're on or whatever. But that's how they were distinguished. But the thing that's a little confusing that I was going to come up with, I'll say it now, is that Joseph Goebbels wrote in 1931 a pamphlet, I would call it a pamphlet, called The Nazi Sozis, Nazi-Sozis, meaning, and then it was, let's see, where's this? Got this here. Questions and answers for National Socialists. And when he wrote Nazi-Sozi, he meant National Socialists. He was calling the National Socialists the Nazi-Sozis, because standing for National and Socialist. But it was also the actual Socialists or Communists, whatever you want to call them, the Marxists, the, you know, party, which was strong at that before Hitler actually finally won out and came to power and was able to do more about it, were called Sozis, the socialists. So, there can be a little bit of confusion there, although it doesn't need to be when you understand that. So then he says that according to the Oxford English Dictionary, and again, I don't think that these people are ever exact you know, are necessarily exactly right, although they're pretty good sources to follow. The first use of the word Nazi in English was by the Times newspaper, that'd be the London Times, on 19 September 1930. The use of Nazi Germany, Nazi regime was popularized by German exiles abroad. And then it spread into other languages and eventually brought back to Germany after the war. Yeah, all that's true. And then he says something about USSR. And this is kind of interesting, so I'll say it. The terms National Socialist and Nazi in the USSR was said to have been forbidden after 1932, presumably to avoid any taint to the good word socialist. You know, the USSR, they revered the socialists. They were socialists, they thought. And so they didn't like the German National Socialists to be using their word socialist. So they forbid the use of that word connected with the National Socialists, the Germans. And they used the word and said fascist. You notice whenever you read what the Soviet Union wrote or said, even today in speeches, Putin uses the word fascist. He doesn't use the word National Socialist. You know, I had never thought about that. But so this is a very interesting piece of information to me from Hermy. But that's why they always, the fascist invaders, the German fascists and so on, they won't use either National Socialist or Nazi. And, Father Glory was happy to hear that confirmation. He thought it was. And then I went to Metapedia. And I looked on Metapedia. And I found that, unfortunately, Metapedia really lets us down here. And I have the quote from here. But first, I'll say what I wrote to Hermy. I said, I think you took some of this from Metapedia. Or Metapedia took it from your source, and Metapedia has only one source of information on their Nazi page. Metapedia has a page called Nazi. And you know, Metapedia is supposed to be our version of Wikipedia. But Metapedia, what I found, I like to go there, but most of the time when they have their information is copied from Wikipedia. And they leave some of it out, and, you know, rarely do they add some of their own. They don't seem to have a staff to do all that kind of work like Wikipedia does. Same story, you know, the Jews have it all. The Jews have all these people working for them, and also just the mainstream has all this money and to pay people and to have people do things, whereas something like Metapedia, which is trying to put out what would be more a version that's more fair to white people or to European people, is doesn't have the means to do as good a job. But in this case, they have information there on their Nazi page that I think is pretty weird. And I'm gonna go into it here, and you can look into it and maybe comment to me in the second hour what you think, or talk about it later, write about it later. But on that page, they have only one source from which they get information, and that is Don McComb's book, World War II, 4,139 Strange and Fascinating Facts. This was published by Wing Books in 1994. Now, that doesn't seem like, you know, that doesn't seem like the best source for what, you know, this whole page. There's nothing more. They say, okay, I already said that. I'm trying to go through this comment here to see if I think I covered all this. So I'm going to go to this. I got it twice. I want to go to this Metapedia page. And here's what they say about Nazi, which I think is very wrong, too. They say it's a political epithet invented by Conrad Haydn. And they've got a little Star David after Conrad Haydn's name. That's interesting. That obviously means he's a Jew. I've never seen that. I just noticed that for him. And he is Jewish. He is a Jew. And he was a contemporary of Adolf Hitler. And he knew Adolf Hitler. They had some kind of a relationship, but not a very good one. And it says that he invented this during the 1920s. He invented the word Nazi during the 1920s as a means of denigrating the NSDAP and National Socialism. As I'm trying to remember now, yeah, here. Haydn was a journalist and a member of the Social Democratic Party of Germany, whose mother was a Jewess. The term is both an imitation of the nickname given to Marxists of the SDP or SPD at the time. Sozi, and a political pun similar to the Austro-Bavarian word for simpleton, derived from the fairly common name Ignaz. It was then popularized abroad by various Judaics and other subversives, including Haydn himself, who fled the country after the NSDAP were elected to government. Now, a lot of people will read this, and this is what they'll take for fact. I don't know. There's no source. There's the source for this. Yeah, is this what I already said? This world. This. This book of strange and fascinating facts about World War II by Don McCombs. So you think you'd need more than that to determine that that this Conrad Haydn did indeed coin this term. He may have been using it. I'm sure he was using it. And but I don't know that he's responsible for it. Okay. It says the term Nazi was used almost exclusively by Marxist agitators, of course. A rare example of its usage by a NSDAP member can be taken from a 1931 work by Joseph Goebbels called The Nazi Sozi, Questions and Answers for National Socialists, that I already mentioned to you. And so in 1931, Joseph Goebbels was using Nazi Sozi to talk to National Socialists, and he didn't see anything wrong with it. So even though all throughout the 20s and so on, their enemies have been calling them Nazis, they still accepted that word for themselves. This is what I'm trying to say. This is what I believe. I want to give one more item here. I've got a few more things I want to, I'm not going to get in before the break, but at Stormfront, there was a very good, there's a short thread on Stormfront about the word Nazi. And, goes all the way back to 2006, July, so that's 7 years ago. But the best comment on there, from my point of view, was, and the most intelligent, was by someone who uses his own name, appears to, named Paul Kruger. And he says, just as, I think this is very good. Just as with all aspects of the Third Reich, there exists a large body of utter nonsense explanations. He uses the word explications, but I changed it to something easier to understand. The word Nazi is a typical shortening of National Socialist, a very common German practice to shorten words. Furthermore, I would like to stress that the word Nazi wasn't an insult given to them. Both the NS press as its opponents used the word without hesitation. The NS press and its opponents used the word. One might state that its opponents use it a bit more, but that doesn't alter the substance. Now, I think he doesn't give any kind of proof here. Well, he's got one thing here. He's got one example. You know, it's very hard to come up with, you know, nobody is able to offer and say for sure when this started and why and what it meant. But the fact, okay, I'll go on with what he says here. He says, let's recall, let's say that it's true the opponents use it more, but that doesn't, you know, alter the fact that it's used by both. Let's recall, he says, the Reichsparteitag, that is the Reich National Socialist Party rally in Nuremberg in 1936, after the reforms in the German Workers' Union. The banner on the left side of the stadium stated, and this is in German, but it's translated, every work unit a Nazi cell. Nazi cell is in German, Nazi Zell, well, it's spelled with a Z, N-A-Z-I hyphen capital Z-E-L-L-E, means a Nazi cell. So they were using that word Nazi. Sometimes it just fits better than to say out National Socialist. And Paul says, if the abbreviation Nazi would hail from Jewish sources, why would they use it in their press and on their political mass rallies? Evidence enough. Well, I think that's very good. I've got some examples of my own that I'm going to give you when we come back from the break. And I'll go on into a little bit more about the Third Reich and some of the things that are misunderstood about it in the second half. And I also invite you to call in the second hour if you'd like to. I'd be happy to talk to you. 1-830-443-4911. Wait until after I come back and I'm on the air after our music is over. 830-443-4911. Well, thank you for listening so far. And after our good music here by one of my favorites, we'll be back for the second half.
Im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die, heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Musik. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt. Was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to the Heretics Hour on Monday, July, I think it's July 8th, isn't it? Yes. And we're talking about the word Nazi. Managed to fill up the whole first hour talking about this word. And I left off with this very nice comment by Paul Kruger in 2006, where he put it quite well, I thought, that both sides use the word Nazi, and the ones trying to make it use it as like an epithet, but it was used as a what would you say, you know, a friendly way, and in a way like you use pet names and shortened names and so on, nicknames and so on for. Which is very typical thing that Germans do. And he said that since they even use it at their party rally, the National Socialists used the word Nazi on a big banner hanging on the stadium in their 1936 party rally, that they couldn't have thought that it was invented by Jews. That's the biggest part. Now, you know, if they thought that... If they thought that their enemies used it, they would, still use it. But if they believed that that Jews invented it, like supposedly this Conrad Haydn that Metapedia says, they would never use it. But they knew better. So to me, I agree with Paul that that's enough evidence. But you know, I have some of my own. I have been posting this material from Willy Wenger, who lives in Austria, and from some family material. I've still got a lot to go if I could find translators. Again, I'm going to put out a word for translators to help me, to not help me because I can't do it. I've tried, it's just too much. Crazy. You try to use Google Translation and then it's so screwed around. And I'm afraid I'm going to get it wrong. So, I could go through a long process and then send it to him and have him check it over and do it. We go through all this stuff, but you know, it's very, very, that's very time consuming. And a person who knows German can do it pretty fast, it seems to me. So I'm still hoping that I do have a couple of people who are going to work on it. When they get time or when they can, but I could use more because you never know how long a person will continue or if they even will. So, I would like to get some people interested in this. Anyway, Willie's brother Leopold wrote quite a bit while he was still alive because he died in 1945, as I've said before, in an air battle over Vienna. Serving in the Luftwaffe, which he served in from 1939 to 1945. And he was awarded the highest honor that I can't even think what it is now. The national, the highest decoration that they have, although not with all the diamonds and stuff. He hadn't reached that, but he was only 23 years old when he was killed. If he had, he would have continued. Well, I don't know what would have happened since they had lost the war. He died in April 1945, right at the end. And maybe he's happy to do so. Who knows? Wasn't much to look forward to after that. So, and he was a very devoted Nazi, as far as I can see. And there I am using that word Nazi again. But I looked through the material that I have already posted and have translated from him, and looking for that word Nazi, because I was sure that I had seen it in there, and I found only three instances of it. But there wasn't too often that National Socialist was used either. Sometimes it was NS, or just, I don't know. But I'm not saying that this was what they used all the time. They did use National Socialist. But here's the examples. The first one is not the best one. The first one I'm going to give is because he was telling about that he had been, he and a friend of his, or a couple of them, were held in the local jail overnight or something because of a bicycle regulation that they had gotten on the wrong side of, something about their bicycles, and they had to spend the night in jail. And he said while they were there, one of the criminals that was in there told, I guess he knew that they were Hitler Jugend, and he told them that a Nazi had recently been sitting in that very cell, and he used the word Leopold used the word Nazi as to what this man said. Now, I looked in the German originals on all these instances to make sure that it was Nazi in the German, and it was. But in this case, he was relating what somebody else had said, so I didn't find this too powerful. But there's a couple of others that are better. In February 1938, he was writing in his diary about the events leading up to the Anschluss of Austria by the Hitler regime. And he says, and that's what happened. From all over the Upper Styria, our SA had gathered here, and already before dark, the main square was completely filled by the Nazis, before the half in front of City Hall was cleared by the police and cordoned off. And in the German original, he uses the word von Nazis. I'm not going to try to read it, but it says, you know, the same thing. It's turned around, you know, in German. But the Hauptplatz was filled with Nazis, and he uses the word Nazis. So that's one instance where he used that word. And he was a leader in the Hitler Jugend. He was really pro National Socialist, and his whole family was. And he was about 16 at this time, but he was really a serious kid. And so he was 100% pro National Socialist and working for Austria to go over to the side of National Socialism and join with Germany, which it did not too long. Here's the next entry, is in March when that happened, and this is March 12th. I think it was on March 11th, but on March 12th he wrote, in the evening we were called away from a meeting in order to requisition cars of known anti-Nazis. And in the German it's Autos bekannter Nazi-Fresser zu requiring, yeah, something like that. It's spelled Nazi and then Fresser. I guess that means, I don't know, that's the same as anti-Nazis. So that's the way that is. And those were the only two that I found in there. But, you know, he used the word. He didn't find anything wrong with it. And this was in 1938. You know, so they weren't, and he knew what the rules were. He knew what was going on. He knew how people talked. And it just wasn't something that was avoided. Now, this article by Joseph Goebbels, Nazi Sozi, Questions and Answers for National Socialists, 1931, he says some interesting things which in this, which will lead me into what I'm going to talk about next. And again, I invite people to call if they want to make a comment about what was said in the first hour or anything on this topic. Okay, 830-443-4911. Well, Goebbels is talking about, this is in 1931, he's, you know, writing, you know, his propaganda pieces, he's writing to people, he's trying to answer questions that National Socialists would have, you know, and he says, you know, as he has said in other things, that it seems the people had this thing about not wanting anything to do with politics. And of course, the NSDAP was a party. Now, it was a political party. We're already 2 years away from Hitler actually winning that majority, and, you know, actually it was in 1932, but, and then being seen as a real contender, and then finally being asked to head the government, although he didn't have an absolute majority, but he had the more than anyone else had as far as votes and representatives in the legislature. So they were doing well, but they're still, you know, they were naturally trying to win people over. And a lot of people were saying, well, they don't believe in politics. Politics is just deception, and it's just gotten us in trouble and so on. He's trying to tell them that, well, here he says, forgive my saying so, but then our mutual enemy, by whatever name you want to call him, capitalism, the Jews, parliament, democracy, or Marxism, has achieved what he wanted. Saying, you know, if you don't get involved in politics, our enemies are certainly involved in politics, and they're gonna have it all to themselves, you know. They're gonna have it their way if we don't get involved in it. And he's calling the enemy, along with the enemy being the Jews, he says you can also call it capitalism, same thing, parliament, same thing, democracy, same thing, or Marxism, same thing. I think that's pretty good, because I've come more and more to see democracy, the whole concept of it. I guess if we talk about the democracy in ancient Greece, you know, or the golden age of Greece and so on, it has some meaning, but democracy today has no meaning. And what democracy is a system that allows multinationalism, multiracialism, that allows the destruction of nations, and of what I was talking about in the very beginning, of a nation ruled by blood and blood connections. I think I was talking about that, or I'm going to talk about it. I don't know which. And, you know, it's kind of it goes along in my mind anymore with libertarianism, that, you know, you have this freedom for everyone and openness, an open society, supposedly, and everyone and anyone can come in and fit in. And, you know, there's no restrictions of any kind, basically, as long as you don't break the laws. Parliament is the same way. Like, if we got rid of our Congress, you know, if all these things are bad, are equal to as bad as the Jews, you know, say if we could get rid of the Jews, how good that would be. Now, is Parliament just as bad? But think here in the United States, think of our Congress. What if we could get rid of Congress? Oh, I think we'd be better off. We'd be better off if we could get rid of Congress. We'd be better off if we could get rid of democracy, because it's not doing us a bit of good. Of course, we don't want Marxism. And then there's capitalism, because the kind of capitalism, really global and Jewish capitalism, is absolutely bad. So, you know, there's a difference between capitalism and free enterprise. Free enterprise is what we used to think we had. You hardly see that word used anymore because we don't have it. I suppose that's why. But when I was young, I seemed, you know, it seemed like free enterprise was the idea. And that you saw that mentioned and written about a lot and spoken about free enterprise. It wasn't, we didn't talk, I don't remember capitalism. Although, you know, when I was young, wasn't that aware of everything, but I was very much, I do remember free enterprise. And we don't, we've kind of, it's shifted. So, yeah, we don't need capitalism. We just need free enterprise. And that's, the Third Reich made plenty of room for free enterprise, really. Maybe not as much as here, but in the United States, but there was room for it. And Goebbels went on to say at the beginning of that article, he has ensured that the German people are not interested in politics. That is saying that the mutual enemy is what he means. The enemy has ensured that the German people are not interested in politics. They can slave away and work their fingers to the bone, and the Jews make their politics for them. So that's the idea of staying out of politics. You're just working. You're saying, I'm just going to mind my own business. I'm going to do, live my life. I'm going to go to my job. I'm going to make an income. I'm going to have a family or not have a family or do whatever I want, and I'm going to stay out of politics. And Goebbels' answer is, okay, you're going to work for them, and they're going to make the politics, they're going to, the way they want it. And that's about what it comes down to. So there's no way to avoid the responsibility of seeing that things are the way we want them to be, or, you know, that you are looking after your own interests of that you think are important, and there's no way to avoid that responsibility. And I have said recently that I think we do need a political party for those who want to join it. Now I noticed, you know, as I was talking about this James Laffrey, that what he's got is supposed to be a party. He calls it a party, but I don't think that he's registered in any state as a party. So that's the difficult part. You can always say, well, here I'm creating this. I've got this such and such party. But you have to be active in politics to make it mean anything. So I'm interested in talking to him, as I said. So what kind of a society was Adolf Hitler's Third Reich? And what kind of a society did the National Socialist Party, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, create for Germans when they had the power? And I'm going to, I don't know how that this doesn't exactly connect, but I'm just going to talk a little bit about German nationalism and leading up to Third Reich. And there's a very important person that needs to be mentioned is Johann Gottlieb Fichte. He's very, very well known. He called for a German national revolution against the French occupiers. You know, there was a time when, after the Napoleon time, that the French took over, actually were occupying Berlin. I don't know how much other part of Germany, they had kind of taken over Germany. And, you know, in those days, the big enemy, the big opponent that Germans had were the French and vice versa. And it was the French and the Germans always, hating each other or I don't know if the people hated each other, but, being set up as enemies to one another. And part of that was that French Revolution that changed France into something kind of something the Germans didn't like. And Fichte, I'm going to call him Fichte because I might be Fichte, but Fichte, anyway, it's best I can do, was making passionate public speeches. He was very pro-German, but also quite an intellectual. He was in the university of Humboldt University, which used to be the Berlin University. He was its first rector, and he was a philosopher. And that was in 1810. And before that, in 1806, the French troops had marched into Berlin. But Berlin was granted self-government. And as you know, the Third Reich forces marched into Paris in 1940, they also granted the French self-government, and they were quite nice about it all. So, you know, they weren't, but at one time, the French had marched into Berlin and taken over, but they at those times, there was a little bit more decency than was not even conceived of. I don't think that anybody would act the way the United States and Britain, Russia, the Soviet Union acted in 1945 to who they defeated. So I think that was probably a first and a beginning of something awful. So in 1812, Jews were allowed to practice all occupations. So that was a bad year. And in 1814, the French were finally defeated in the Sixth Coalition, and Berlin grew from 200,000 to 400,000 and became the fourth largest city in Europe. And then, going back to Fichte's nationalism, it was populist. He was very much the populist and opposed to traditional elites. He promoted German exceptionalism. They like to make that point, you know. But any nation, if you, I think any nation that wants to protect itself and that loves itself, that wants to keep its freedom, has to think of itself as exceptional. I don't think that exceptionalism has to be a bad thing, because naturally nobody in their right mind thinks that they're better than everybody else. And, you know, but exceptionalism can be a way to say, you know, we're all for ourselves, you know, and we think we're important, we think we're great, and we think we deserve good things. And if you don't have that, if you say the other, if you say, well, we're no better than anybody else, this is what we're supposed to do now. We're supposed to say we're no better than anybody else in the world. And you know what that comes down to, I have realized, is that you soon become less than everybody else in the world. Because if you're no better than anybody else, then anybody else can take your place. And anybody else can do what you do. And you don't even need to exist, because somebody else can pick it up and take it over. So if your race or if your nation goes down the tubes and you don't exist anymore, well, that's all right, because there's other people in the world and they'll do everything that you've done, and you're not really needed. So you have to have a bit of over the top, maybe a little bit over the top love for yourself and concern for yourself and your people in order to just survive and to keep yourself you know, a part of the game. Otherwise, you're going to go down. So I think when they talk about exceptionalism, they kind of miss the boat there. And put across a wrong idea to people. Now, some of the stuff they wanted to do under Fichte's German nationalism was to purify the German nation. So already there in the 1800s, they had this idea about purifying the Germans and not having it be polluted by all kinds of foreign elements And one thing they wanted to do was purge the German language of French words. And that was something it says in this source that the Nazis also undertook when they came into power, that they were working on purifying the language or purging the language of foreign words, and particularly, I guess, maybe they didn't like French words. I don't know. I'm just saying that's what it says here. Now, Volkisch nationalism also denounced soulless materialism, individualism, and secularized urban industrial society. So this Volkisch movement in Germany was really almost a kind of, I think, it wasn't a back to nature movement, but it was a back to German folkishness and, you know, pure German countryside, the people, the ordinary people. And so they were against materialism and even against individualism, too much individualism. And they didn't like secular industrialization, urban industrialization. And they thought an advanced society was based on ethnic German folk culture, the folk culture, the old ways and so on, and German blood. Now, I think this movement goes too far in the way of romanticism and natural law and so on, because you can't, in the modern world, you can't just, you know, go back to such simple ways and think that you're going to, you know, be able to function amongst all these modern nations that if they feel like it, just going to walk all over you. So I can't say that I agree with this, but it was something that was typically in the German soul, because it was, you know, it's been something that Germans related to for a long time. There's a lot of this kind of feeling in the 1800s. But, and you know, in the 1930s, the Hitler Jugend and the Bund Deutscher Mädel, the BDM, the League of German Girls, those two young people's movements that were really going great guns in the 1930s, and they were organized and they had a lot of youth in them, and they were very active, and they spent a lot of what they did was promoting folk culture among the ordinary people. And they were organized in rural areas, because I know Wilhelm Christmann was involved in that in his area in Austria in the 30s, and his sisters too, and they did all that stuff, you know. They went to these villages and they they organized singing and dancing and all the old original kind of things that the folk culture, and they kind of brought it back to life again or tried to, and they dressed accordingly, and they had puppet shows was a popular thing, because I guess that was always something that was popular in Germany. To tell stories through these puppet shows and all this stuff. You know, I'm a little bit mixed feeling about this. Some of it seems too, they wanted to make Germany German, you know. They wanted to bring out this Germanness. So they were busy doing that. But National Socialism itself realized that, you know, it was also working in the modern world. So, but this was the old nationalism from the 1800s, and it was still going on. They were still a part of the National Socialist Party was still promoting this kind of thing for their youth to do. And, but a big part of German nationalism, even going back then, was anti-Semitic. And if some of it was anti-Slavic, and some of it was anti-Habsburg, and it was often anti-Catholic. Now, in southern Germany, as far as I understand, and also, of course, in Austria, the church was very dominating, and everybody was Catholic, and they had the people pretty much, to do whatever they said they needed to do. The church spoke with authority. They wanted to keep its authority, And, you know, they had even parties that was a clerical party. And the National Socialist, the Nationalist Revolution, you might say, those who were nationalists, didn't like that, didn't like the church, and they stood against it. And their parties were the German nationalist parties, and the church had its clerical party. And they were seen as kind of the enemy. And that went all the way through until Hitler came into power. And now here, it was in 1871, with the unification of Germany, you know, under Bismarck, the 1871, when he finally managed to do that. At that time, there was a sharp increase of Jews into prominent positions and wealth. And so this anti-Semitism, well, we know it goes, we know that the power of the Jews in Germany started as soon as they got freedom, too, as soon as they got the ability to have the rights that they had not had at times, you know. Now, the church never wanted to give rights to the Jews. That's one good thing about the church. But the government, New Germany under Bismarck, the United Germany, was a liberal-minded, welfare-minded government. It wasn't anything bad like what we have today, but it opened up a lot of things, and that included opening things up for the Jews. And the empirical evidence, it says in this Jew-friendly source I'm using, empirical evidence demonstrates that from 1871 to the early 20th century, the Jews who lived in Germany were overrepresented in Germany's upper and middle classes and underrepresented in Germany's lower class, and particularly in the fields of work of agriculture and industrial labor. So, you know, they as soon as the Jews got the opportunity, they were able to move up and become wealthier and get into middle class businesses and professions and so on. And they were not at all represented in Germany's lower class, which Germany always had. They had their laborers and their farmers and people that didn't even have a farm, but that worked on farms, you know, farm workers. Well, it was a lot of people were farm workers. They didn't make much money. But of course, the Jews didn't want to do this, and they didn't. This was noticeable, and well sourced. And Jewish financiers and bankers started playing a key role in things, and they played a key role in fostering Germany's economic growth from 1871 to 1913. Get that? The Jewish financiers and bankers played a big role in fostering Germany's economic growth from 1871 to 1913. That is getting Germany prepared for war. Getting Germany set up to be ready to say, well, you know, we can go to war, we can fight, you know, for in this, we don't have to put up with what is being done. And of course, Germany got into the First World War in 1914 because of what they set up for Austria. You know, they had the treaty with Austria, and they had this Austrian Archduke, who was the heir to the throne, be assassinated in public, just like they assassinated Kennedy, I guess, to assassinate him and his wife in public by the Serbians, who I believe were communists, who I believe were maybe Jews. But anyway, these anarchists and so on. And the Habsburgs ruling Austria had to do something about it, and they tried to get, you know, some kind of satisfaction, which they weren't able to get, and the whole thing then you know, from behind the scenes, war was promoted in one way or another in order to bring about this big war. Now, in 1908, amongst 29 wealthiest German families, here's more thing about the how much power the Jews got. In 1908, halfway between, you know, before the, as they were working towards starting a war, among the 29 wealthiest German families with aggregate fortunes of up to 55 million marks at the time, five of these families were Jewish. And the Rothschilds were the second wealthiest German family in Germany in 1908. And Jews were estimated to have accounted for 1% of the population. 1% of the population. So I think that if you're talking about 29 wealthiest German families, it should have been less than one family, that the Jews would be amongst this group. But they were five of these families. And of course, just compare all of this to us today in the United States. What seemed like way too much and was harming the German people as they saw it from what the power of the Jews in their country then. It's nothing compared to what we have in the United States today. And other nations too, particularly other white nations. But we get these figures about the Jews that are like, of the 100 richest men in the world or richest people in the world, you've got 40 or maybe sometimes it seems like it's even over 50% Jews. And they're supposed to be, I would say maybe 3% of our population. I think it's more than what they say. So maybe 3% of our population. And we've got, you know, they're like 40-50% of all the success, all the money, all the so on. And when you come into other areas of powerful areas of life, sometimes they're close to 100%. You know, they can, when you talk about media, when you talk about banking, they're just so dominant. It's beyond belief. So we are far, far worse off. And we still have people who can't manage to think that there's a problem. Now, just to go on here, so resentment was growing in Germany and radical anti-Semitism was promoted by a few people like Eugen Diedrichs, Paul de la Garde, and Julius Langevin. And listen to this. This Paul de la Garde called the Jews a bacillus, the carrier of decay who pollutes every national culture and destroys all faith with their materialistic liberalism. And he called for the extermination of the Jews. These were prominent advocates of Volkish nationalism, it says. And this is, you know, they were able to say things like this. Of course, the Jews and the Jews' friends would have been saying things back and saying, oh, I shouldn't say that. But he did say it. And I wonder, we can't say things like that today, but our situation is even worse. And this Langevin, Julius Langevin, he called for a war of annihilation of the Jews. And he says he wanted genocide of the Jews. Well, they called it genocide. And his policies were published by the National Socialists and given to soldiers on the front during World War II, it says. But he was earlier than that, so they must have thought that was pretty good stuff. And that's what they say here. And I don't even know if this is true, you know, because this is anti National Socialist source here. So I don't know if they, what the Nazis did. They no doubt did something with it. but you can understand that the Jews were alerted by all these people saying these things and making plans to protect the advancement they had made. You see, I think, as usual, the Germans were saying all this stuff just out loud. showed that maybe they were too open and honest and too free-spoken, but that's the way they are. That's the way we people are, and we can't help it. And as they were talking this talk, you know, and trying to get people to see the problem, the Jews were planning what they were going to do about it. And they were, you know, I think these people were ignorant of the deeper nature of Jewry, as so many of us are. I don't know if any of us really appreciate how bad Jews are. I think there's a few people. There are people. They're the ones who will say something like this. They're the ones who say, even this, I was shocked to find on this James Laffrey's website, whiteswillwinparty.com, that he says this. He is saying this, and some of his commenters are saying this, and they're agreeing that that Jews are trying to destroy us, and we therefore have to turn around and destroy them. That's the only answer, because we've tried everything else, and kicking them out of the country and so on, you know, doesn't, they just thrive somewhere else, and then they come back, and you know that the only way, that's what they're saying there, is to kill them all. That's what he says. He says, kill them all. Kill them all. We have to kill them all. This sounds like what these blacks are saying about the white people. Kill them all. I don't know. You know, that's why I wanted to talk to him. People would say, probably some people do say, well, he's an agent. You know, he wouldn't be talking like that. That's not smart to talk that way. Well, he seems like a very mild guy, and he just kind of woke up a few years ago all the way, he says. Well, anyway, when you talk like this, you are kind of, I'm just of mixed mind about it. You are kind of letting the Jews know that they better stop you and they better do something. Because they don't accept this. You know, we can't just talk about doing something about the Jews without the Jews working on plans to do us in, because they have that sense of self-preservation far stronger than probably anybody else in the world, and kind of like ants do. I've got an ant problem right now, and I'm trying to get rid of ants out in the yard. They've just gotten so numerous, and you know how they are. They can get some of them, but they're able to survive no matter what. And I think these Jews have a system where very, very hard, and just to talk about annihilating them is not going to do it. But, you know, the fact, what I want to point out here is this is how strongly some people felt, and they understood at that time that these Jews were not just an ordinary kind of problem. They were beyond that. They were something beyond that. And it took extreme means. And this was long before Hitler or the National Socialist Party, but this was nationalists. Now, this Fichte was still around, or at least when he was around, he was accusing the Jews in Germany of having been, and inevitably continuing to be, a state within a state. We've heard that many times, and that they threatened German national unity. And this was an argument that was used at the time. And you know, they're a state within a state everywhere, and they're a state within a state in the United States, and they have certainly destroyed American national unity, have they not? I mean, we have a country really under the rule, under the thumb, under the influence of political influence and political power. They have the political influence of international Jews, of pro-Israel Jews, Jews working for Israel, loyal to Israel, and we don't have any American national unity anymore, partly because of all these people they brought into this country to become, quote, Americans, unquote, but also because we're not able to talk about our problems in an honest way, because they're the problem. You know, if they're the problem and you can't talk about them, you can't discuss and do anything about your problem. Now let me, okay, it says, I'm going to skip that, okay, it's too confusing. There's a guy named a sociologist, German sociologist, Johann Plenge, who spoke of the rise of a national socialism in Germany within what he termed the ideas of 1914 that were a declaration of war against the ideas of 1789, the French Revolution. So here he was, I don't know exactly when he was, but he was using the term national socialism before the national socialists did. You know what, they were still opposing themselves to the French Revolution, which was a Jewish Freemasonic effort, very similar to the Bolshevist effort in Soviet Union, in Russia, And he talked about that the ideas of 1789 included rights of man, democracy, individualism, and liberalism. And these are all things that are seen as not good. They, you know, we've been conditioned. Well, I was conditioned all my life to believe in these, and most people still do. Not all of us anymore, but still do. These are sacred words that you can hardly, you know, speak out against. But he had the idea that you needed to reject all this in favor of the ideas of 1914. I guess he meant the beginning of the war, that included German values of duty, discipline, law, and order. These are the German values he saw. Duty, discipline, law, and order. Over and above rights of man, democracy, individualism, and liberalism. He did believe that ethnic solidarity, or what's called in German Volksgemeinschaft, would replace class division. Class division was not good. And that racial comrades would unite to create a socialist society in the struggle of proletarian Germany against capitalist Britain. So these people were very idealistic. I think this is a bit overly idealistic. Although I'm a very idealistic person, I've gotten less so. I've gotten more hard-hearted and hard-bitten as I've learned so much of this stuff. And so I don't want to fall for this. And I see this, I think, you know, it's nice to think that people are going to do this. And sometimes they make a good effort beginning in it, but, a beginning effort. But it doesn't seem to take into account human nature. And human nature is, a sense of individual self-preservation is built into our human nature. That's our sense of what's that called? That we all have a right to defend ourselves, and our first instinct and interest is our own self. And so, things come in to purposefully, we are infected with ideas from the enemy, you see, to break up our racial comradeship and our ethnic solidarity and so on, and our idealism. And that's when they get these people to function as traitors or as disruptors or as problems. Your own people, you know, and it's not that hard to find those people, not that hard to do, particularly when you put people into any form of hardship. So, you know, we're not supermen. We aren't. And this is something that we have to be very aware of. Here's a couple of myths. I'm just getting to the myths now. That National Socialism held racial theories based upon the belief of the existence of an Aryan master race. And this is still repeated. It's repeated all the time whenever they write about Nazis or National Socialism, and it's simply false. It comes because the Jews were viewed in National Socialism as a mixed race that had infiltrated multiple societies, and they were responsible for exploitation and repression of the Aryan race. So this is the view of Jews, and because National Socialism held this view of Jews in a sense then an inferior race, because they called them a mixed race that were infiltrating other races and so on, are infiltrating other societies, I should say, that they go from there to the fact that National Socialism saw itself as a superior Aryan master race, which it was looking to improve. National Socialism was looking to improve the gene pool, to improve the German race, the German nationals, to improve health-wise and intelligence-wise and all of that, to try to encourage the best and not the worst. And that does not, though, translate to an Aryan master race. And then this idea about excluding women. The ideology excluded women from political involvement and from the military, from participating in the military. That's all. That's all that I know of. You know, it's commonly said that women were confined to Kinder, Küche, and Kirche. Or I think it's Kirche. Kucha and Kirche, the children, kitchen, and church. You know, they could be involved in childcare, in the kitchen, cooking and meal for preparation and so on. And of course, involved in the church. That's a good place for them. You know, go to church every day and be pious. That's really not the way it was. German women were not treated that way. It is true that they were. The idea was that men had to be employed first. As soon as the National Socialists got into power, they started putting that into practice. And first the men had to be employed. And that's how unemployment went down so much. It wasn't just because women had those jobs, but they created a lot of jobs. But the jobs went to the men until there was full employment among the men. And then if they needed more employees, then they could hire women. But there were areas where it was only women, you know, where women were the usual people to do that kind of work. And but women were encouraged to raise families, and there was a very much disapproval on abortion. But I think most women certainly go along with that. That didn't seem to hurt the women in Germany any. And then homosexuality. In 1933, homosexual organizations were banned, and scholarly books about homosexuality and sexuality in general, it says, were burned. I don't think very many books were burned, but probably these books were put out of circulation. Why would you want to read, you know, scholarly books about homosexuality, explaining why it is and so on? They just decided that they didn't want homosexuals in the society in Germany, and the Gestapo supposedly compile lists of homosexuals, for whatever reason. Homosexuals actually were not bothered unless they were engaging in open homosexual acts in public. And the idea was that they wanted all German men to conform to the German norm. And there was such a thing. And I agree with it, even though it can be difficult for some people. But that's what you have to do to have a healthy society. I think the only people who don't like this are the homosexuals themselves. And look again, when you let the homosexuals go, when you give rights to the homosexuals, like you give rights to the Jews, they behave just like the Jews, if you ask me. And I've been trying to, you know, find opportunities to say this, because what I see is homosexuals as a group function almost exactly like Jews as a group. They are intelligent. They are aggressive. They want to keep going. They never get enough. They want to take over. They want to make everything in their own image. And they don't care about society as a whole. They only care about their own interests. They're, because they see themselves as a persecuted, minority who's been looked down upon, who's been shunned, just like the Jews, and therefore they think there's nothing that they can't do to make up for all that. And they don't have any sympathy for the non-homosexuals, just as Jews don't have any sympathy for non-Jews. And I think they're really two of a kind, and they are a bacillus in society. So even though there's individual suffering and doing something about them, they have to be held down. And homosexuals who really, really have that sexual identity actual confusion should be given help. And I do think that there's a way to help. They just don't want to be given help because they like living the way they live. So then there's this idea that Hitler had little interest in money or economics. Well, he didn't have that much interest in personal money. He gave away money. He spent his money on what things that to help the arts and so on. And but he was very interested in economics, and he had he ordered and attended many meetings on the subject before he became chancellor. And he spent a lot of time studying it and figuring out and talking with people and getting the right people in place and so on. So I don't know where that idea comes from. But he thought that, and he also believed that private ownership was useful because it encouraged creative competition and technical innovation. But he did insist that it had to conform to the national interest. That's all pretty well known. Well, that's as far as I can go, ladies and gentlemen, on today's program. I want to thank you very much for tuning in and staying with this program tonight. And I will be back, of course, next week and tune in to all the programs here on the White Network during the week. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.